We don't have a name for our subseries just yet. This is another subseries of the Vietnamese podcast, and my co-host is John Phan. The reason why we don't have a name for it is because it will be covering a lot of different things, not just linguistics, right, John?
Thank you so much, Kenneth. It's great to be back. Yeah, I hope so. I think, there's lots of conversations to be had, especially about pre-modern Vietnam, Vietnam before the 20th century, before even the 19th century. I think there's a lot of great conversations we can have about where a lot of the things we think about as Vietnamese today, where they actually came from and how they developed. So I'd be so thrilled to have those conversations with you on a broad range.
Yeah, this is beyond linguistics, but I think right now we're probably going to study and talk about the history of the language, of the Vietnamese language.
Yeah, I'm super excited because, of course, that's my core interest, is the development of the way the Vietnamese language was shaped over time. So it's great to start there.
So just like the other subseries that we have in the Vietnamese podcast, I like to ask for, a little bit of contribution from our audience, donations to, get our professors a little bit of some money, because they put a lot of work into the research before the episodes go on, and there's a lot of time that they spend. So I like to have a little bit of something for the co-hosts that come on to these subseries.
Yeah, thank you so much, Kenneth. That's really appreciated. A little coffee money, a little haircut money, maybe. I need a haircut soon, but also, I love the work that you're doing. So I love, I hope that we're all able to support ongoing conversations of this type. So yeah, please do help us out a little bit.
Thank you, John. So I think what we're trying to do is we're trying to figure out the structure of this new subseries. What I want to do is pick and aggregate a few questions from our YouTube comments. Mm-hmm. And I have three, and they are related to today's topic, but we will ask them. And so then maybe we can go into richer detail as we're going through this episode. So the first question that I've aggregated is, it seems to be that there are some terms that need to be defined. And there's four terms that I'm interested in having you kind of break down. Is Sinitic, Austroasiatic, Annamese, and Kradai. Those are the four.
Yeah,
I have even the pronunciation I've jumbled up, but hopefully you can break these down for us really quick.
Yeah, that's a great question. It's really useful. So linguistics is super annoying, like many fields, for having a lot of jargon, a lot of terminology. And we have to name a lot of different things. So most of those terms you just mentioned are names for different language families. So a language family is a collection of languages that are genealogically related to one another, just like in your family. And, so we have extended family members, and we have closer, like, nuclear family members. And we name each of those families. So Austroasiatic, the first term, is the name for one of the biggest, one of the five large language families that is represented in Asia. And Austroasiatic includes most of the languages that historical linguists think of as being spoken in mainland Southeast Asia, or once were spoken in mainland Southeast Asia. So the two biggest, most populous representatives of Austroasiatic are Vietnamese and Khmer. They're kind of like cousins of one another. So that's the Austroasiatic language family. Another one of the big language families of Asia is Kradai. That's the second term you mentioned. Kradai, it used to be called Thai Kadai, but now we've renamed it Kradai. And Kradai is the language family to which modern day Thai and Lao, and what we call the Thai languages in Vietnam, they all belong to that language family. And they're also mainland Southeast Asian languages. So those are two big language families in Southeast Asia specifically. There are the other language family I'll mention, which is relevant for us, is Sino-Tibetan. Sino-Tibetan is the big language family to which, as you can hear, the Chinese languages and also the Tibeto-Burman languages, the languages related to Tibetan and Burmese, are all related to that. They all belong to that group. So that's the third large Asian language family. And then there's a couple more, but those are the main ones. I also heard, I think you ask about the term Sinitic or Sino. I say that a lot. So Sinitic or Sino refers to what we would in like normal language call Chinese, but sometimes we prefer the term Sinitic or Sino because, as we talked about in our last conversation, when we say Chinese, we get confused. We start to think about modern day China. So if you're talking about, for example, the Sinitic language spoken 2,000 years ago, 2,500 years ago, we want to make sure that you don't think that we're talking about Mandarin, you know, or Cantonese, or languages spoken in the modern PRC. So Sinitic or Sino is a way of referring to Chineseness without referring to the modern day Chinese polity. Okay. You'll also hear me use the term literary Sinitic sometimes. That's like literary Chinese, or sometimes it's called classical Chinese, but we use that term exactly for the same reason. So that's Sinitic or Sino. I think you also asked about animes, that's maybe, right. Yeah, so this is a really, it's a good to ask this question because the term Annam is very contentious in Vietnamese studies. So for a couple of reasons, Annam refers to many different things, but in the colonial period, Annam was the central, the middle part of Vietnam, right? It was the middle territory of the French colony. And before that, Annam was also the term that the Ming dynasty, that the Tang dynasty from the 6th to the 10th century used to refer to the province of what is now northern Vietnam as it belonged to the Tang dynasty. And the Ming dynasty, when they conquered Vietnam in the 15th century, also used that term. So all of that's to say is that some people don't like the word Annam because they think of it as a colonial term for Vietnam. But it, in reality, was the name for the region for many, many centuries. And many Vietnamese also called themselves Annamese for a long time. It was a very popular way to refer to one's own cultural identity. So in my book, you can see my book is called Annamese Middle Chinese and the Origins of the Vietnamese Language. That's the little subtitle here. I call a Chinese language or a Sinitic language that was spoken in that area Annamese because it was spoken in the province of Annam during the Tang Dynasty. So when you hear Annam, you can just think of it as a way to refer to most specifically the Chinese province that corresponded to northern Vietnam in that time. Did I miss a term?
Nope.
Were those all the terms?
That's all the terms.
You've done it again, finance teams. You closed the books, and it went fine. Sure, some expenses were missing receipts, but that's fine. Stayed late to process invoices by hand. It's all fine. But don't you deserve better than fine? With Ramp, expenses are submitted with a text, invoices are coded automatically, and everything is connected to your accounting system, so you can close the books without all the busy work. Switch your business to ramp.com and love finance again.
If you work as a manufacturing facilities engineer, installing a new piece of equipment can be as complex as the machinery itself. From prep work to alignment and testing, it's your team's job to put it all together. That's why it's good to have Grainger on your side. With industrial-grade products and next-day delivery, Grainger helps ensure you have everything you need close at hand through every step of the installation. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
And more. You added there another one. Each one of these can have its own standalone episode of, you know, of this sub-series. And that's why I'm so excited about, you know, because, you know, I've grown up reading here and there of these terms. And, you know, I've always wondered what Annam referred to. And there could be like a whole sub-series episode that is dedicated to this history of Annam and you know, why it's so contentious, and you know, the idea of it being a colonial thing is also very interesting too, because my question, and we don't have to get into this right now, but it's like a question of like, well, did we come up with that name, our people from that period, did we come up with it, or did the French, you know, come up with it and just kind of permanently etched it into the history of the West as that, you know, that time period. So there's like so many things that we can discuss And there's another side to there's another question that an audience member, John Yu, sent to us, and it's within the same family of questions, but where did the North, Middle, and South, so North, Central, and South dialects come from? How did they kind of evolve into where they are today?
That's such a good question. And I need to preface my answer by saying I am not really an expert on what we call dialectology. There are some great experts on Vietnamese dialects out there that you know, we can maybe give that information out in another format. But I can answer the question kind of briefly. So the first thing to note is that languages change automatically. So even if, you know, nothing happens, you will diversify into dialects. Now, North, Central, and South are the main three dialects of modern-day Vietnamese. And it's a little confusing because for most of history, all the way up until the 17th century or so, or the 16th, 17th century, the southern border of what we call Vietnam or Đại Việt in that time was what is now Central Vietnam. Because in Central and South Central Vietnam, there was the Kingdom of Champa. So when we think about how dialects diversify, they diversify in the middle. They innovate in the middle of the of a community, and those changes, they radiate outward, okay, from the center of that community. So when you get to the edges of a speaker population, sometimes you get a lot of diversity because they're maybe still more conservative. They haven't accepted a lot of the changes that occurred in the center. And also, when you think about the southern border, that old southern border, which is now Central Vietnam, you're talking about speaker populations of Vietnamese who are in contact with non-Vietnamese speaking peoples, especially the Cham peoples. So in Central Vietnam today, the central dialects evolved, have a long history of evolving very distantly from the standard speech of the North, and also undergoing influence from non-Vietnamese speaking peoples. So that's a way to understand why the central dialects are so divergent. As anyone knows, it's very difficult. I mean, I'm throwing shade now at the central dialect, but if you're not a speaker, it's very hard to understand, right? And that's also a way to understand why the southern dialects are closer to the northern dialects than the central dialects. Because as we talked about last time, the Nguyen clan who founded the South, they're from the North, right? So there's a thing that I cannot explain to you because I actually don't really know the answer. And that is that Hue was the capital of that clan. So there's a historical mystery there for me. I think there maybe is a linguist out there who can answer this question. But the dialect of the South, centered in Saigon, is much closer to the northern dialect than the dialect of Hue. My impression, and it's just my impression, is because Hue is in that region that was the border zone for so long. And even though it served as the capital, the local dialect was still very strong. Whereas the dialect of Vietnamese that was brought to Saigon, there was no local dialect in Gia Định area. So they brought a kind of standard, more standardized northern dialect down with them, and then it changed in the south. So that is one incomplete answer to the question of where we get these three major dialects. And the main thing you want to remember is that the center was for most of history, the border zone, which is why it's so different.
This is my fifth year of doing this podcast, and I can't tell you how excited I get to hear these kind of answers and responses, especially when you are somebody that lives in this space and you're saying that there's still this mystery that you don't know. There's so many beautiful details and nuggets of the work that we exist in within our history. And it's a really cool question is,
yeah,
how is the center of this country so different from the North and the South, which is like on the, you know, they're on the extreme ends of it. That mystery is so cool. And I hope that we can get to that answer eventually, as we're going along the subseries. And the last thing before we get into our main questions for the day is, how much is our Vietnamese language influenced by India? That's a question mm-hmm. that came from one of the comments in the YouTube.
That's a cool question. Yeah, that's a really cool question. So I think there's two ways to answer that. The first one is, remember, Vietnamese is genealogically part of the Austroasiatic family, the Southeast Asian mainland Southeast Asian language family. And that language family stretches from the Vietnamese language in the East, that's the easternmost spoken Austroasiatic language, but all the way to what are called the Munda languages in India, in modern day India. So that's a huge range of these languages. And if you think classically, that means that all of those languages, from the Munda languages to the Vietnamese language in the East, originated as a single language, not necessarily a single people, but a single language that diversified over time. And we don't really know exactly where the homeland of that ancient Austroasiatic language is, but it was probably somewhere between Vietnam and India, somewhere, you know, in that area. And then it sort of spread and diversified and changed. But we're talking very ancient history when we talk about that relationship. So the common ancestor of the Munda languages in India and the Vietnamese language was spoken many, many, many thousands of years ago, thousands of years before recorded history. So there is a kind of connection there, but it's very, very ancient. The more immediate relationship between the Indian languages and Vietnamese is borrowings, cultural and linguistic borrowings from the Indian languages, particularly via Buddhism. So this is... I'm going to answer only briefly because this is another episode which would be great to discuss. But Buddhism obviously arose in India, but it comes to Vietnam via two routes. It comes to Vietnam over the sea, kind of directly, well, sort of from India through Southeast Asia up through Champa and into what is now northern Vietnam. And it comes also overland, over the Silk Road, through China into Vietnam. And most of what we think of as Vietnamese Buddhism is that second route through China. So, and then we have a lot of Indian words in Vietnamese language that come from Chinese borrowings of ancient Indian languages, Sanskrit or Pali. And then we also have some borrowing from that other route, the direct route. So there's a lot of stuff going on there. And then the last thing I'll say is that the more immediate presence of Indian culture and language that's proximate or next to Vietnam is in the kingdom of Champa, which is this kingdom that we've talked about a couple times, which was once in central and south Vietnam, and they were an Indic civilization. Their cosmopolitan or orthodox official language was Sanskrit, but they also wrote in Cham. And in fact, the oldest Sanskritic stele or epigraphy is from what we think of. We think it's from what was a progenitor of the Cham kingdom. So, and that's part of Vietnam today. So India has a lot of influence on Vietnam in many different ways. Yeah.
Yeah.
I don't know if that answers
that. It does. In an early episode, I had back Le Van Qua. He was, you know, he's in his 90s now. And he talked about, in a very general way, I remember him saying, it was like my first year in the podcast, he said that the Vietnamese people can generally be broken down into two cultures, Indian and Chinese. And I was blown away because, you know, I really never studied any of this stuff. And to hear that for the first time, I was like, India, what does India have to do with Vietnam? And this is me being very new, very green. And I began to start to hear this influence of India in our culture throughout the years. And now having you talk about this, I think the idea of Champa and India it deserves its own few sub-series, because the language and the culture of Champa and the history of that world is something that is a complete mystery to somebody like me who,
yeah,
you know, we're not in that space, that I'm not in that space where I'm learning this stuff. But it's like, it's an integral part of who we are.
I totally agree. Cham culture is such a huge part of a huge ingredient in modern Vietnam. And it was such an important, powerful kingdom for a super long time, you know, like many, many centuries. So it's really like it's a lost world. Like that, so few people are aware of this incredibly flourishing civilization, you know? And yet it's there. And also not only that, but that there's a huge number of Cham people that are living today that are the descendants of that kingdom. They live in Vietnam and Cambodia, you know? So they're not only, Champa is not only this important part of history, it was kind of a regional superpower, really, you know? It was the main rival of the Dai kingdom for many centuries. Not only is it part of an important part of history, but it's an important part of modern Vietnam. You know, there are so many Cham communities in Vietnam today. I love that idea.
Yeah.
You know, for an episode.
You know, I can't stop reminding everyone when I think about growing up as a Vietnamese American, thinking that the only thing that I really thought about myself was I am a product of this war, and the Vietnamese person that I am is a monolithic sort of description of me coming from this thing in 1975 in April 30, and that's all I knew. I did not know that there were so many branches of like things that created who I am ultimately am today. And now, you know, we get to talk about all of the details and the colors and the textures of our culture. It's so beautiful, John.
Yeah, I love that. I love that. I think that's a great way of talking about trauma. You know, in some ways, trauma is just we get stuck in one point. And freedom from that trauma gives us the opportunity to explore so much. So I think that's very beautiful.
All right. Now we're going to get into the history of the Vietnamese, the spoken language. So exciting. So our question in this episode is Vietnamese. Is Vietnamese just basically Chinese? You know, is it, you know, when we think about like all of the proverbs and the Confucian sort of like the four words that will kind of give you a proverb or an adage, all comes from, or I've always thought that it comes from Chinese. So, you know, how closely genealogically related to the Chinese language is Vietnamese?
Yeah. So is Vietnamese just Chinese? No, that's the first answer. And then the second answer is sort of. So let's get into it. So I like the way you broke it down because there's different ways you can answer that question. And the first way is genealogically. Is Vietnamese genealogically related? And when you think of genealogy, you want to think of the analogy in biology is genetics, right? So like, am I genetically related to that person or not, right? And then there's, of course, a bunch of other stuff like, was I raised by that person? You know, is my personal culture influenced by that person? So the genealogical question is the first one. And the answer is unequivocal and it's clear. And the answer is no. Vietnamese is not genealogically related to Chinese. And that means that they do not share a common ancestor. Vietnamese and Chinese did not descend from the same common ancestor. Because as we talked about at the beginning of the episode, Chinese descends from is a Sino-Tibetan language, and it descends from this ancestor that we hypothetically call Proto-Sino-Tibetan, you know, before it split off into all the different branches. And Vietnamese is an Austroasiatic language, and it descended from a hypothetical language we call Proto-Austroasiatic. And Proto-Austroasiatic would split over time into languages like Cambodian, Munda, Vietnamese, etc. So not related. That's the first important point. And that was a kind of relatively recent, maybe discovery is the right word, because 150 years ago, people did think that Vietnamese might be a Chinese language. They thought the earliest linguists thought Vietnamese was either related to Chinese or to Thai. It was either a Sino-Tibetan language or a Kra-Dai language. And it wasn't until the 50s when a very famous French linguist gave solid evidence that Vietnamese could not be genealogically related to Chinese. But why did people think that? Why did they think that Vietnamese might be related to Chinese?
Because every cell in my body is fighting is fighting this right now.
Yeah, look, when you are give me the CEO, it's very hard not to think, oh, maybe Vietnamese is related to Chinese. I mean, and that's one of the first reasons that the vocabulary is so Chinese. So depending on how you count, over 60%, usually over 75%, and sometimes even over 80% of Vietnamese vocabulary is thought to have to be Chinese in origin, right, to be some kind of Chinese borrowing, yes, right? So that's a huge percentage of our native vocabulary. You know, there are some words that we don't really even have a native word for it anymore, or we have a native word and we don't really use it, like, and very basic vocabulary, like no, head is a Chinese word. It's a cousin of the Mandarin word tou, you know. And we do have a native Vietnamese word for head. Jiao means head, but nobody says jiao unless maybe you're from some interesting dialect in the center. You might still say jiao. You know, there are some dialects that still do that. And for example, the Muong languages, that the word for head is jiao, or it's cloy, something like cloy. So it's related. But so we have so many words that are from Chinese, and even some basic words that are from Chinese that one would think, oh, maybe we're related to the Chinese languages. But those are all consequences of deep, deep borrowing.
Okay, can I stop you right here? Yeah? Okay, so 60, 70, 80%.
Got to itch my ear. Sorry. Go ahead.
60, 70, 80% are words that come from Chinese or Sinitic. Mm-hmm. That is a huge number that has infiltrated the words coming out of our mouth as Vietnamese people. So How could a theorist say that it doesn't come from Chinese when, let's say, up to 80% of our words can be argued that there are roots from the Chinese language?
Yeah, I mean, exactly. It's crazy, right? But that's why when we say genealogical relationship, we mean one very specific thing. We don't mean that it isn't related, it isn't influenced by, or it doesn't have a connection to. We mean it did not descend from a common ancestor. And I'll give you a metaphor, and then I'll answer your question more specifically. The metaphor is, maybe I'm adopted by this family, and everything that I like, all of my tastes, like the kind of food I like, the kind of movies I like, the language I speak, they all come from my adopted family, my adopted parents. But maybe my adopted parents, you know, are Koreans and I am Mexican, you know, like genealogically, genetically. My genetic parents are from Mexico, but I was adopted and raised in a Korean household. So you can see, like, maybe I love everything Korean because that's what I'm used to, but that does not explain my genetic heritage. So the genealogical heritage of Vietnamese is like that. Like, Chinese does not explain, Vietnamese does not come from the same genetic place or genealogical place as Chinese. But then all this stuff, it's part of the history of the Vietnamese language, and it comes in that way. So that's a good general way to think about it. But if you're asking, how do we know that Vietnamese is not genealogically related to Chinese? Well, languages influence each other in specific structural ways. So some things are borrowed and some things kind of are very difficult. Some things are easy to borrow and some things are difficult to borrow. And there's a kind of hierarchy. Words are easy to borrow. I mean, think about English. We have so many loan words from many different, you know, languages, and different types of words are easier or less easy to borrow. So cultural words are very easy to borrow. So in English, we have words like sushi, tsunami from Japanese. It doesn't mean we're related to Japanese. It means we're in cultural contact with Japanese. And then words like body parts are what we call basic vocabulary, and those are harder to borrow. So we typically think that generally your basic vocabulary is not going to be borrowed. And if you have some borrowings in your basic vocabulary, it means that you were in really intense contact with another language group. So if you look at English, the basic vocabulary is pretty Germanic. And then you have another layer of borrowings. So animal names are also sometimes, unless they're borrowed, if they're in the group, they're usually more basic. So you can think about the difference between pig and pork. Pig is a Germanic word, swine is the word, the Germanic word. But the word pork is borrowed from French because although it refers to like pig meat, it's like a culinary term, so it's borrowed from French. So what I'm trying to say is that by looking at the proportions of different words in a given language, we can decide where those words came from, if they're borrowings. And I should also mention English has a huge proportion of French words in it. Like I don't remember exactly the statistic, but it's like 60%. And English is not a French language. I mean, English is not a Romance language. English is a Germanic language. And yet it has this huge proportion of French words. And the reason for that is very similar to the history of Vietnamese and Chinese. The other way we know that Vietnamese is genealogically not related to Chinese is we look also at other structures of the language. So language is typically divided up into the lexicon, the vocabulary, the syntax, which is the grammar, and the phonology, which is the sound system. And we can look at each of those systems to see what its most basic features are and decide whether those basic features are held in common with another language or not. And and if we look at the phonology, for example, if you look at the sound system of Vietnamese, it's true, we have a tonal system, which seems to be like, that's why so many early linguists were like, oh, it must be Thai or Sinitic. Because only the Kra-Dai and the Sinitic languages have tone similar. There are more languages that have tone, but they have the most similar types of tone. But if you look at, for example, the vowel system of Vietnamese, you know, if anyone who's out there who is not a speaker of Vietnamese has learned Vietnamese, you know, we have all these central vowels, like, you know, we have you know, all these central vowels. That is a very typical feature of Southeast Asian languages. So that's another clue. We know that Vietnamese is not genealogically related to Chinese. But if you really want to know the big discovery that was in the 50s, as I said a minute ago, early linguists, one of the main reasons they thought Vietnamese was related to Chinese or Kra-Dai is because Vietnamese has a tonal system that looks almost exactly like the tonal system of the Thai languages or many Sinitic languages. And this historical linguist discovered that tones originated from consonants. Originally, they were consonant contrasts at the beginning or the end of the syllable. And then as we lost people stopped pronouncing the specific consonants, and they started turning those consonants into tones, right? So that's the origin of tone in any language, virtually. And not only that, but then he discovered that, oh, the specific tonal system in Vietnamese came from these specific consonants that we see in related, some ethnic minority languages that are related to Vietnamese. And a similar process happened in Chinese, but the specific origins are slightly different. So he showed us that we cannot use tone to argue that Vietnamese and Chinese are related. And in fact, the origin of tones shows us that they're separate. So that's a little bit of a technical answer, but just to answering the genealogical question, we can say no, Vietnamese is not genealogically related to Chinese.
The hardest part of talking with you is...
You've done it again, finance teams. You closed the books and it went fine. Sure, some expenses were missing receipts, but that's fine. Stayed late to process invoices by hand. It's all fine. But don't you deserve better than fine? With Ramp, expenses are submitted with a text, invoices are coded automatically, and everything is connected to your accounting system so you can close the books without all the busy work. Switch your business to ramp.com and love finance again.
Holding back with the flurry of questions that are going on in my mind right now.
Ask questions, ask them.
So yeah. Many. How many academics agree with this theory? In modern Vietnam today and all over the diaspora, how many people are going, that person, that theory is right? And then how many people are like, that's absolute dog crap? Like,
yeah, good question. That is such a good, I always ask that question when you come across an idea, like, because, you know, academic consensus is important, you know? So within the linguistic community, within the community of experts on linguistics, I don't think there's anybody who really disagrees with this argument. It's really incredibly well accepted. And since 1954, since the original argument was forwarded in this way, the evidence has just accrued. It's just gotten greater and greater and greater to support this genealogical argument. I don't think there's really any reputable linguist, I'm going to get in trouble for saying that now, but any reputable linguist who does not agree that Vietnamese is an Austroasiatic language. There are, of course, some people out there who do disagree. And maybe there's some interesting points. And, you know, there might be something to that, but it's fairly well agreed. But I'm just talking about the genealogical argument, right? There's many other things.
It's literally like saying, I mean, what a great analogy. Like, when I think about English and I think about, oh, it did not come from Latin. It came from the Germanic side. And I've always thought that Vietnamese was related the same way Italians related to the Latin language, but it's not. That's like that's what I grew up thinking is Vietnamese is no different than Italian, which is sort of like the modern offshoot of Latin, but that can't be further from the truth.
Yeah. Do you mean like Vietnamese is related to Chinese the way Latin is related to?
Correct.
That was the idea. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Yeah. It's a good, that's right. So it's even the genealogical relationship is even more if you use the Germanic analogy, like German is not a Romance language. Yeah, that's a good way to think about it. You know, Italian, French, Portuguese are all Romance languages that are descended from Latin, but German is not. That's a good way to think about Vietnamese and its relationship to Sinitic or Sino-Tibetan languages, except for the fact that if you go further back in history, German and Italian are related. They do come from Indo-European, which is like the super, super, super great, 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 great grandfather of all of those languages. So there is a genealogical relationship there. Whereas as far as we know, there is no genealogical relationship at all between the Sino-Tibetan and Austroasiatic languages. Okay. As far back as we can go.
I have a question. Does linguistics 101, like the first class you take in linguistics, does it break down like the first language or like a tree, like a division tree, a language tree? I know this is so like, I feel like a little kid. Is it like, oh, here's the first language and then it just slowly breaks down into like a family tree of languages?
Yeah.
Or no, is that too basic?
That'd be awesome. Yeah, well, no, it's an important way to think about it. So first of all, what we're talking about and what I work on is what we call historical linguistics, which is different from the rest of linguistics. Like the rest of linguistics doesn't deal with the history of languages. It deals with the structure of language as it exists in this moment and the universal structure of languages. So that's different than asking how languages change as systems over time. So that's historical linguistics. So historical linguistics 101, to sort of modify your question, we do talk in terms of language families. We talk about the genealogy of different languages in the world. I mean, it's one of the main things we do is try to figure out which languages are related to which languages and how. That's an effort called classification and subgrouping. I love your question. Like, it's one of those sort of like, you know what tiemzaw means? Tiemzaw? Like, one of the tiemzaw, like, yeah. Topics would be to talk about this. Is there, for example, was there a single original human language, you know, that all languages descend from? Scientifically, there's no evidence for that. You know, like, and we don't know when in the biological history of humankind did language actually arise. So as far back as we can go, we have these super language families like Indo-European, like Sino-Tibetan, like Austroasiatic, and those go many, many thousands of years back. But we don't have any idea of how they might be related to one another. And the thing is, like, by the time you get that far back in history, your evidence is super, super scant. So you can only really, you can't really do any scientific work that far back in history. But it's fun to ask that question to think about.
Oh, wow. I didn't even know that. I didn't even know that that's like a thing where, you know, it's Tiemzawable. It's just, you know, it's something that
it's a good word.
It's just something that you can just, you know, banjavuide, but it's you can't really. Yeah, there's no records, right? In anthropology, there's no way that you can get to none of the records.
Yeah,
the features and vocabulary of Vietnamese is different from the rest of the family, and I know that you bring up the idea of Thai Kradai and Sinitic languages. This idea of this intense joining or not collaboration, because it doesn't sound like the word collaboration makes sense, but contact with,
yeah, contact
with the Chinese language. So does that mean that all of the words that were present in the language before the Chinese came in, does that mean that it all just sort of like goes away, or does it get blended in? How does that work when the Chinese show up?
Yeah, great. So yeah, back to the is Vietnamese just Chinese kind of question, because this is where Vietnamese is very Sinitic. You know, it has a lot of Sinitic features, the vocabulary, but not only just the vocabulary, which is what you're asking about, but even the sound system, and even to a certain extent, the grammar of Vietnamese. So what you're asking about is how contact works in a way, and how did Sinitic contact exert itself on the development of the Vietnamese language? And shout out to myself, sorry, but that is what this book is about. So if you're interested, it's not that cheap, but it is actually on sale right now at Amazon, probably because they can't make it, no one's buying it, so they put it on sale. So please buy it. Anyway, that's what the book is about. But so like I mentioned a minute ago, there's like levels of intensity of contact. So like the gentlest contact, meaning like two speaker populations in communication with each other that maybe have words for things. One language group has words for things that don't exist in the other language group. So naturally that other language group will borrow those words and those ideas. A good example, again, is sushi. Like, sushi didn't exist in the English world until they had contact with the Japanese. So they not only borrowed sushi as a concept and sushi as a dish, but they borrowed the word for it because there is no English word for it, right? So that kind of borrowing is very mild. It doesn't mean that the two societies are very deeply, you know, associated with or in very intense contact. And then you can have sort of different levels of intensity going from there. When we look at the Chinese vocabulary in Vietnamese, what we see is we see those types of words. We see cultural words, you know, like modern borrowings, for example, like li si si yao in Southern dialect of Vietnamese, lots of food words and things like that. But we also see lots of other types of words that are of Chinese origin, words that we don't tend to think of as Chinese. Are in fact of Chinese origin. And for example, a lot of grammatical words, you know, and a lot of verbs even, you know, verbs, grammatical words, and even grammatical systems like the classifier system, you know, gai, mot gai, hai gai. That gai is not only a Chinese word, but the system of using that type of word is a Sinitic system. So we see a lot of these types of borrowings, and it for linguists, it makes you pause and be like, first of all, you're like, is Vietnamese related, you know? And then you look at all the other stuff and you're like, no, Vietnamese is not related. So we have to figure out where all these words came from, you know? And what you have to posit is that there was a really, really intense form of contact between these two languages. And this is where I really can get lost in the weeds. So I'm going to resist that temptation. But to make a very long story short, the first thing you do is you split up the time depth of each of those words. Like, when was it borrowed? Was it borrowed in the 20th century or was it borrowed in the first century? You know? And most of the work I did in my book was a phonological analysis of the sounds of the Chinese words to divide them up into different time depths. And we have 3 to 5 different periods in which Chinese words were borrowed. And each of those periods, they're borrowed in a kind of a different way. So the last period, which I call recent Sino-Vietnamese, is the mildest form of contact. That's basically modern times, you know, like 18th, 19th, 20th centuries, maybe 17th century, where we get a lot of Cantonese speakers in the south, in like Gia Đình area, in what is now southern Vietnam. And we get a lot of Cantonese borrowings and also Ming borrowings that are mostly cultural or food words, words like li si. Words like si yao, you know, si yao. And that's why, by the way, si yao is the southern word for you know, we say nuoc tuom in the north or something else, you know, because those Cantonese speakers weren't in the north. So that's the most recent type of borrowing. And then the like 80% or over 80%, maybe, I don't know the exact statistic, of Chinese words that exist in Vietnamese were borrowed in a middle period. I call it late Sino-Vietnamese. and they are most consistent in their form with what we call Middle Chinese, which is the form of Chinese that existed before the modern dialects of Chinese diversified. That's typically what we think of as the Tang Dynasty and a little after the Tang Dynasty. So 6th through 10th, 11th centuries or so, that's a, kind of the middle period. So then you've got to ask yourself, why are there so many words borrowed that have a form that's consistent with this middle period Chinese? And the answer is that, well, first of all, you got to remember the area of northern Vietnam and the area where Vedic speakers lived was part of the Chinese Empire, not only during the Tang, but from the Han through the Tang dynasties, from like 1,000 years. For 1,000 years, that area was part of the Chinese empires. And not only that, but I kind of misspoke in the last episode. I said the area of the Red River, if you remember the Red River where Hanoi is today, that was the site of the largest city of the empire. What I meant was the largest city in the south, in the far south. So the biggest Sinitic city, the biggest Chinese city of the Han through Tang empires up until the middle of the Tang was actually in the Red River, was actually in the area of modern-day Hanoi. So what does that tell us? It tells us there was a lot of Chinese speakers in that area. And it tells us that they were living alongside a lot of speakers of the ancestor of Vietnamese, what we can call, well, I call it ancient Northern Vedic, but just think of it as the ancestor of modern-day Vietnamese. And what we need to imagine is that this was a society that was bilingual, that you got to think of a city like Zhaoqi, which is the, you know, ancient site of Han through Tang, which eventually became Hanoi, as a city where, and a country, a province where people spoke both Chinese, a form of Chinese, and a form of Vietic, a form of the ancestor of modern Vietnamese. And probably many families, many, many families themselves were bilingual. And that was a condition that's very common in the ancient world. We think of it not common today because even though, you know, you and I, all of us who are Vietnamese Americans, we're all mostly from bilingual households. And yet somehow we're brainwashed into thinking that bilingualism is a weird thing. But it's the norm for a lot of history, for most of history. So we got to think of that area of Vietnam over this 1,000-year period as deeply, deeply bilingual, if not more, if not trilingual. And so we've got families who speak Sinitic and Vedic in different conditions. And because they're bilingual, the form of each language is being changed. So think about it. If I'm a bilingual speaker of both a Sinitic language and a Vedic language, then when I speak Vedic, I'm going to drag a lot of Sinitic elements into my Vedic. Just like, you know, we talked last time about how Vietnamese diasporas in America are proud of speaking the Chuẩn Vietnamese, the pure Vietnamese. But think about it for a minute. Is it really? Because my sale is not a pure Vietnamese word. Like when you say cell phone and you call it my sale, like that is an English word. Sale is an English word. And like, think about when you really get in that into that Vinglish space, when you're like, you hum thích cái này, you hum thích cái kia, and you're saying you, like you're taking a English pronoun and you're using it in your Vietnamese. And that's because you're bilingual. That's because you speak both Vietnamese and English. And Spanglish is like that, you know, like all these sort of mixed dialects of a language that borrow. So you want to think about the way in which these people spoke Vedic over this time as mixed in that way because they're bilingual. So they're kind of mixing their Chinese in with their English or with their Vedic language. And that is the condition for many, many centuries. And then through many, many processes after the area of northern Vietnam becomes independent in the 10th century, but probably a couple hundred years. It takes a couple hundred years after that. The people, these bilingual families, they slowly abandon spoken Chinese. They slowly stop. The same way, if you look at the Vietnamese diaspora, you know, it doesn't take many generations for Vietnamese folks in America to kind of stop speaking Vietnamese, right? You kind of switch. So that's what we call language shift. So they're shifting from Sinitic to the Vedic language, or they're abandoning one of the two languages that were native to the area. And the language that they end up speaking is this deeply Sinicized, this deeply Chinified Vedic language. And that Sinicized dialect of Vedic, that's the origin of the Vietnamese language. That's why Vietnamese seems so Chinese, because it's this weird hybridized dialect that was hybridized through these long, long centuries of bilingualism. And my favorite analogy for imagining that kind of a mixed language is Singaporean English, Singlish, which I cannot speak, but you can look it up on YouTube. You can hear it. It's a dialect of English that has deep grammatical and phonological and lexical vocabulary influences from chiefly from the Ming Chinese languages, but also from Malay and even Tamil. So that's where the Vietnamese language comes from, this deeply hybridized dialect as the result of centuries and centuries of bilingualism with a form of Chinese that was native to the area of northern Vietnam, which I call, again, Annamese Middle Chinese. That's the name of that dialect.
You basically just explained and answered the question that we posed in the beginning of this episode. Right there. That's really the way it goes down. Period.
I think so, yeah. But is it yes or no then? Is the answer yes or no? I wonder how people will feel, you know? Because it's complicated.
But this is the history of humanity.
Yeah. Exactly.
This is why we go to war. Right. This is why we have like political factions. This is why we go to war inside of our own family structures. You know, mm-hmm. And when you were describing all of this, I think about the you and me part of the English when you just brought that up is when I'm talking to one of my mom's younger brothers, they're old enough to be an older brother to me, but they're also my uncle. And it's really interesting that when they want to kind of like show equal footing out of respect for me, they switch to the you and me. They don't take out.
Oh, really?
They don't.
Oh, interesting. Yeah.
And it's a beautiful thing that puts me in a weird place, in a great place, actually, that we could be arguing about, you know, Trump and the politics of America, and they start to go to you and me so they can allow me to say what I want and don't have to kind of push their uncle status on me.
Yeah.
This is a beautiful dance.
That's fascinating. Yeah. And it's really related to the same process by which a lot of those sung ho, a lot of those terms of address came into Vietnamese. Yeah. Because in almost exactly that kind of a situation, you can imagine Vedic speakers wanting to express the inverse of that example, wanting to express a kind of hierarchy, a kind of respect. They're going to they're going to drag in the Chinese term for the elder. And so if you look at terms of address in Vietnamese, usually the older term, the elder term is of Chinese origin. So jie is a Chinese word, but am is an Austroasiatic word.
Wow.
So you can imagine exactly that situation where you have a bilingual family, but then they're like, you have to show respect to your elder. And then they're going to use the Sinitic word, the Sinitic pronoun in those situations until the point that it becomes just the Vedic word. You know, and that process repeated itself a million times. And that's how the Vietnamese language was born, through this kind of process.
You know, when you're telling me about all this stuff about tracking these words in the history of our language, and thinking about like Minority Report, and I'm thinking about like the digitization on a big kind of like virtual screen, and I'm thinking about your work. And when I think about the depth of the research, it boggles my mind, because how do you dip into 800 years ago where the word just shows up for the first time? Or how do you make these sort of relational, sticky sort of showing that they're related? Who does the heavy lifting of, I'd imagine today AI could probably help a lot with this stuff, but you're coming up in your career, how does all of this fit together, the theories and going back to the records? I mean, I can imagine there's so much printed or not so much printed and not so much oral kind of tracing. It boggles my mind to understand how you do the archaeological sort of, quote unquote, the digging up, the proverbial digging of words.
This is a really good question, because you're right. Some languages are lucky in that they have written records going back thousands of years. Chinese is one of the oldest continuously written languages in the world. So we've got written records to help us do that excavation. But with a language like Vietnamese, you know, Duodenum does not get developed until the second millennium, to 1200s, 1300s, 1400s. So we don't really have records of written Vietnamese before then. So how do we do it? We linguists use a methodology called the comparative method to reconstruct earlier stages of the language. And the comparative method is a method by which we determine what modern languages are related to one another in the way that we talked about earlier. And then we look at the systems of those languages that are related, and we compare the differences and similarities of those related languages. And then we reconstruct what must have been the common point before those two languages diverged. So if we have X form in this language and we have Y form in that language, we kind of we reconstruct what must have been the form such that both X and Y could have been the result. So that's the comparative method. It's a little bit like, it's a little mathematical the way it's done.
Yeah,
but it's the only way for us to sort of get at the form of the language that existed in a time when we had no written record of it. So that's how we know what the sound system, for example, was like in an earlier period. So that's the way it's done. And it's painstaking because you have to document the modern languages so that you can do that comparison.
And has AI, the introduction of AI, has it really changed the game for you?
That is a good question. So the quick answer is I don't know, because AI just happened like 5 minutes ago. Yeah. And most of my research was done, much earlier. At least on this topic, but things are changing immediately at this moment. And I think my feeling about AI, I have a lot of feelings about AI, complicated feelings about AI, both good and bad, but it's going to be an incredibly powerful tool for this type of analysis, as long as we train it correctly. So we've been using computational methodologies for a long time in historical linguistics, a different kind of method. You could call it AI. You really could. It's not generative AI, which is the new sort of revolution. But we use what's called phylogenetics. It's a branch of historical linguistics, which is using algorithms to reconstruct family trees based on data. So we feed data to the algorithm, and we train the data in a certain way. We give a little bit of information for each of the data points, and then the algorithm produces the genealogical tree, the family tree for us. And that's what, for example, evolutionary biologists use to create the family trees of different species, because they feed in thousands and thousands and thousands of genetic characters to get those trees. But producing those trees is very laborious for a human. So, the computer can do it for you. So that has been part of historical linguistics for a long time. I did a tiny bit of that, although I didn't, I wasn't very deep in that work. But historical linguistics uses it a lot. So already we have that history. And now with generative AI, I honestly, I don't know how that's going to affect the field. But certainly automating a lot of the work is going to be very helpful, because you do have a lot of data and you do need sort of like a tool that will help you sort it in a sort of more efficient way.
Breathtaking.
I mean, it's a really interesting question, the AI stuff. I'm curious. I think there are many people out there who are going to answer that question better than I am, especially, younger linguists who are doing their work right now. We've got databases and databases and databases, and who are figuring out new ways in which to use AI to help them manage that data. Yeah.
So we've covered a lot of the questions and points that you've brought up, but not everything. So I am probably going to fold into the next episode, perhaps a part two to the question of, is Vietnamese just Chinese? Or we can sort of like tweak our next topic to kind of fit into sort of these literary traditions that overlap. Yeah. Is the second part of what we were planning to do today. So if that works for you, we could, we can convene for the next episode.
Yeah, I think that's a great idea, because the whole world of written language is different than the spoken language, right? And the question of, is Vietnamese literature or literary expression or writing, is that Chinese? Is another, it's a whole other question. But for this question about the history of the Vietnamese language, you know, and the way in which it was formed and shaped, you know, I hope people understand that that question of whether it's Chinese or Vietnamese, A, it's a good way to engage, I think. It's a good way to think about it. But I hope that once you hear the history of the language, you understand the complexity of where a language genealogically comes from versus where all the different forms and structures of the language actually are shaped, you know, through influence and contact and things like that, that you see that there's no real way to answer that question satisfactorily, because Vietnamese is both Chinese and not Chinese, right? And once you start learning about that history, I would encourage people to let go of the need to decide whether Vietnamese is Chinese or not, because in the end, it's a limiting question. And if you let it go, you can see, as we talked about many times, you can focus instead on a kind of dazzling complexity to the language, you know, and that's the important thing. That's the thing to focus on. It's very special.
And you bring up a point. Why are we so obsessed with this? You know, that's the crazy thing. Why am I so damn addicted to this question? And I think it goes, you know, obviously the way we sit around the dinner table, we talk about these things sometimes, and we debate. And it is a good part of our what occupies our kind of like our national identities almost.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's right. I mean, it's not a bad question, but it's a question, I think of it as a gateway. That's the question through which you can enter a whole different world, you know? So yeah, anyway, it's been really fun talking about it. I really appreciate the chance to talk through these things. And I hope that listeners will have questions, you know, more specific questions about the range of things we talked about. I'd be very happy to answer any questions that anybody has.
Yeah, we've gotten a lot of engagement in your first episode. So we encourage our audience to leave questions and comments. Just full disclosure, it's very difficult for somebody like me to answer anything in the comment sections because a lot of it is way over my pay grade. So I can't answer and leave comments to kind of like rebuttal. There's no rebuttals for me because it's really complicated. So we'll bring those questions and comments into episodes into the future. So John, thank you so much. It's, you know, obviously I'm like a little kid now in the candy store. I mean, just being able to talk to you and guys like, you know, Professor Kevin Pham with the Vid History Makers subseries is, this is really what I live for. And I can't believe I'm living in this day and age where I get to talk to guys like you and Kevin.
Oh, it's so fun. I love it. And I can't wait to come back. Thank you so much.
Thanks, John. Appreciate it.
Yeah. All right. Take care.
Thank you for listening to The Vietnamese with Kenneth Nguyen. Special thanks to Brittany Tran, to Jane Nguyen, Catherine Nguyen, Tina Pham, Sydney Jamie, and Crystal Trin. Please find us on Instagram, Facebook, and TikTok at The Vietnamese Podcast.
You have 5 new messages.
Hey, Carl, it's Jen from Finance. Could you submit your expenses this week?
Hey, Carl, happy Friday. It's Jen, Finance. Just need those receipts today.
Me again, Carl. Really need those receipts, like last week. Please just tell me where they are. Are you by your desk right now?
Finance teams, you shouldn't be chasing down Carl or anyone else. With Ramp, expenses are sent with a text and reminders happen automatically. Switch your business to ramp.com today and love finance again. Sally from Finance loves fly fishing. She used to spend her weekend surrounded by receipts. Then she switched her company to Ramp. Now, spend is all under control, all in one place. Her team submits their expenses with a text, and she can close the books without all the busy work. So Sally's weekends are all her own, surrounded by fish, not receipts. Switch your business to ramp.com and love finance again.